There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott. In this hour, we'll continue our special report on the future of the travel industry. Today, we are lifting the lid on loyalty schemes. Plus, as the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi heads to the UAE this week on a surprise visit, we'll look at the economic implications. But first, gold prices remaining stubbornly high in the wake of global economic turmoil. Gold expert Jeff Rhodes tells us what impact it's having in the gold souk.
So gold, another six-year high at the back end of last week, $1,534 an ounce. What's the story behind the number?
It goes back to the start of August when Donald Trump ramped up the trade war spat with China, which coincided with the Fed cutting interest rates and gave gold a significant boost. And we saw the price rally from probably around $1,350 to a high of $1,535 last week. You know, quite an incredible rally and lots of things going on. It's almost a perfect storm in favour of gold at the moment. And Richard, I think the key factor that happened last week, something close to your heart as an economist, was the inversion of the US Treasury yield curve and the 10-year yield falling below the 2-year for the first time since 2007. Now that's a big deal, really. I mean, we can talk about the Fed, you know, cutting interest rates by 25 basis points or hiking by 25 basis points. When you get this inversion of the yield curve, it happens rarely and it signals bad times ahead. Now, is it just man-made? Well, all recessions are man-made, but the signals are not good. And when you look at the gold price this year, Richard, despite the fact that the dollar is up a couple of percent, the Dow Jones is 10% higher, gold is up 18%. When you've got a strong dollar, strong equity market, gold's up 18%. I think it's telling you something.
Well, the inverted yield curve is credited with predicting every recession since World War II. What's the correlation with gold been since that time, Jeff? Well,
I think probably you'll find from World War II, of course, gold was $35 an ounce fixed until 1971. But definitely it is that safe haven where people go to when there are times of trouble. And you look at physical gold. Physical gold is the way to go. But I think, you know, when you look at the interest rate scenario, definitely if you had dollar interest rates at 10%, there would be no interest in gold. 2% and 1.5%, there's no real opportunity cost from holding gold. So I think there is a very strong correlation.
I was talking with one business owner last night who said, I heard you banging on about the inverted yield curve for the past couple of days. And the question is this really something I should be concerned about? Or is it just you as journalist exaggerating for effect and trying to make a story when there isn't one in the slow summer months? What's your view, Jeff?
No, my view is you're absolutely right. It is a big deal. As the fact is, we haven't seen this scenario since 2007, when we were at the peak of the, you know, junk bond scenario in the US, when, you know, mortgages were being sold to people who had no money, and that gave a boost to the US housing market and so on. But it was the first sign of a problem, and certainly those that did see the global financial crisis coming would point to that. So I'm not saying it's going to happen, but the gold price up 18% in the face of a strong dollar, in the face of a strong equity market, is strange and does suggest something unusual is on the horizon.
How high could gold go? Morgan Stanley is saying that if we see a deepening of the trade war with China, that we could see a US recession in as little as 3 quarters. How high could gold go in response?
Well, look, above 1550, if you look at the charts, the point of stiff resistance of 1550, above that, honestly, 1600 is the next stopping point. Then from 1600 to 1800, there's nothing there. If you look at the charts, there is no resistance. So 1800, I always said that I would never see the all-time high of 1920 that we saw in September 2011. I always said we would never see that again in my lifetime. I am getting older, but probably still a few years to go. It could be that we could see gold at 2000. I definitely think we could. I never thought I would actually sit in the Dubai Eye studio and say that, but I do think there are enough things going on in the world and if you like, headwinds to the global economy, that gold could make that move.
Well, you talk about those headwinds. There's the US-China trade war and the inverted yield curve. Those are the big economic stories. There's also the Argentina currency collapse. There's Brexit happening at the moment. And there's the unrest in Hong Kong. And you've just come back from Hong Kong. You were there on a business trip. How is that playing out in the gold market in Hong Kong, Jeff?
Well, look, the physical traders around the world are very smart. Traders, we tend to buy high and sell low, but the physical guys tend to sell high and buy low. And if you look at the gold price physically, it's attracting a lot of selling. Well, the mood there was okay, but it was a bit muted, as you can imagine. I actually arrived in the face of last Monday, just 30 minutes. I cleared the airport 30 minutes before they closed. Honestly, it wasn't that bad. It was more like being at a Spurs-Arsenal football match, to be honest with you. I actually quite enjoyed it. It was quite fun. But, you know, seriously, the implication of Hong Kong isn't really just that. It's because the US and China have got the trade war spat going on, and it doesn't do anything to improve that scenario, which, again, is bullish for gold.
You mentioned physical buying there. What could it mean for Diwali? Higher prices, will people still buy in the same way?
People will always buy it during Diwali and other festivals because that's what they do. They buy. The difference is if you've got a gold price at 1500 versus 1300, you buy less simply because of the price, but you will still buy.
Finally, Jeff, this week, we've got a busy week, haven't we? Jackson Hole is happening it starts on Friday, doesn't it? This is the big gathering of central bank officials. You've got the head of the Fed is going to be there. What are we expecting from Jackson Hole?
Well, look, I mean, we're in the scenario of central banks around the world cutting interest rates fairly aggressively, trying to ward off GFC 2.
And so GFC?
Global Financial Crisis 2. Because that's what the inverted yield curve is predicting. I think it's a very, very interesting weekend. All eyes will be on that gathering. And we're looking for signs and signals from central banks about monetary policy. Will they aggressively ease? Will they be conservative? I think the message will be rather conservative, but nevertheless, I think this focus on monetary easing rather than trying to rein in inflation is actually, once again, good for gold.
Jeff, great talking to you. Appreciate your time. Thanks very much indeed for joining us. Jeff Rhodes of Rhodes Precious Metals Consultancy.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott.
Call me loyal. I'll say hello.
We're talking loyalty programs, and it's all part of our special report on the future of the travel industry. We kicked it off yesterday with a guy called Chris Lund, and if you're listening to that interview, he's head of the hotels division at the consultancy Colliers International, and he was sharing his three game-changing megatrends for the hotel industry. One was the rise of the cheap hotels like Oyo in Asia. Another was the rise of Airbnb. But the third of his megatrends was loyalty programs becoming increasingly important, particularly the giant ones. The likes of Accor, the big French hotel chain, have just revamped their loyalty scheme. Marriott as well has just revamped its and called it Bonvoy. And Chris Lund of Colliers, we asked him, are they really that important to hotels? And he says yes.
They do. They are very, very important. And as you're saying, they are investing hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars into these programs in terms of marketing and the partnerships, etc. They do bring about 30 to 50% of the guests into the hotels, depending on the region. Obviously, traditionally, the US has been stronger for loyalty program customers than the Middle East. So it's a little bit less important in the Middle East.
Why is that, do you think?
I think because traditionally in the US you had a very traditional corporate market, while the Middle East has been a very fast transforming market with new hotels. So if you are stuck with one chain and you go to a new market, there's not necessarily a hotel in the location you want to stay of that particular brand.
Chris Lund of Colliers.
Yeah, see, I'm not sold on the hotel loyalty points. You think it's because I don't travel enough? I've just spent a month in Australia and I didn't stay in a single hotel. Would a loyalty scheme have made the difference? I don't know. I collect the cards, I sign up for them, and then I unsubscribe to all the mailing lists.
I think the loyalty cards for hotels, but the research suggests that loyalty schemes for hotels are particularly powerful for people who would do a lot of business travel when they're not paying the bill. You earn the points when someone else is paying the bill and you spend them on yourself on holidays. That's where they come in. You and I spend very few nights in a hotel in any given year where someone else is paying the bill.
But we go on holiday. So are the hotel loyalty schemes missing a trick in terms of devising a plan for the holiday maker? Here's the thing. I've been looking at a report called the Loyalty Report. It comes out every year. It is the industry benchmark for that year. The 2019 report suggests that an awful lot of us are in loyalty schemes. The average American belongs to 14.14. Three-quarters of Brits are members of schemes, but we're not necessarily happy with how they are performing. Satisfaction by sector. Only 42% of us are satisfied with our airline loyalty schemes. Only 40% of us are happy with our sort of clothing and retail loyalty schemes. Only 46% of us are happy with our credit card. There wasn't a single sector that got above 50. Movies got
nothing. Got
the
above 50.
That was the most satisfied were people who've got movie loyalty cards, and they were. That was literally half as to those who were and those who weren't. We're also leaving an awful lot of points on the table. Every year, around $100 billion worth of points are unused. And that suggests to me that we either forget they're there, we don't care about them, or it's just too complicated to cash them in.
We've got a Twitter poll running this morning to get your views on loyalty schemes, finding out whether or not you're still using them. The question we're asking is this. Talking loyalty points this morning, we're asking, have we reached peak points? We're giving you three options. One is, I still love my points. Two is, I'd rather have the cash. And three is, I don't use loyalty plans at all. It's kind of even Stevens. Most people would rather have the cash. 48%, nearly half of people would rather have the cash. A third say, I still love my points. So there's still a significant minority who love the points. And about one in five, one in six people don't bother using any kind of loyalty scheme at all.
See, here's the thing. I am not a statistician. I do not work with algorithms. And I don't want to collect points that I have to do some kind of massive mathematical equation around to figure out how to cash them in and can I get a seat on this date or can I buy X but I can but only on a Tuesday and if I do it 6 months in advance. That is a faff. When I was back in Australia last month, there were two clothing brands, Country Road and Witchery, that I shop at quite a lot. When I was shopping, they said to me at the till, are you a member with us? I was like, probably. They looked me up. Yes, I was. Both of them said, oh, you've got, you know, $30 or $20 with us. I was like, do you want to take it off this purchase? The answer to that is obviously yes. And then your new purchase accumulates some cash against the next purchase. So it gets you coming back to buy things and it is instant gratification and it is money off your bill and you can see it and you can feel it and it absolutely influenced where I shopped.
Lots of people have been in touch about this, sharing their views, including Khalud, who says that she loves collecting points.
I collect miles, air miles, usually, and I collect them to get upgrade and enjoy all the benefits, you know, upgrading on the higher classes, like business class, for example. That's why I'm doing it. My bank offer me to upgrade my card to collect more points. For example, if you do, for example, Tenderham transaction, it will turn out like you'll collect 20 miles, something like that. So it gives me a privilege to collect more miles.
Lots of people writing in saying they're big fans of their scheme. Someone writes in saying, I greatly enjoy XYZ large international hotel chain membership. I'm a platinum member. It took me roughly 2 years to get it. I get one free night for every 4 or 5 nights I spend, and I gladly use that to pamper my mom or my aunt or other family members every now and then. I travel a lot without them. These points kind of help me to actually spend time with them. Others, though, have a very, very different view. Someone writes in saying many of these loyalty schemes are a waste of time for the average Joe blogs.
Yeah, I'm busy. I'm busy. And I can't... Half of them I forget that I'm a member. Half of them I forget to carry the card so I don't have it to pull out and use at the time. And I don't want to have to sit down and do some kind of sophisticated equation in order to cash them in. To say nothing, by the way, of those schemes, some of which, it must be said, are the schemes that I do use, where your points expire in your birthday month. So they send you an email saying, happy birthday, Richard. By the way, use all your points now because they're about to expire in 30 days.
Other big stories we're covering on. We have got a special visitor joining us in the United Arab Emirates in the not-too-distant future. He is the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi. We don't know much about his visit yet. We know that he's going to be coming at the back end of this week, going to spend a couple of days here before heading off to Bahrain. We don't know if he's going to be doing a public event here in the UAE. No plans have been announced yet. This, though, is him a few years ago when he was in Dubai and did do a rally at the cricket stadium. I was there and it was extraordinary.
तालियों की गुंज से क्राउन प्रिंस का अभिनंदन कीजिए क्राउन प्रिंस को स्टैंडिंग ओवेशन दीजिए भारत माता की बहुत बहुत धन्यवाद.
That is Narendra Modi. We know that economic issues are going to be very close to the top of the agenda, $60 billion worth of trade between the UAE and India. We've been speaking to some experts in Mumbai to find out how important this visit is. From an Indian perspective, Gaurang Shah is a senior stockbroker in Mumbai. He's vice president of the brokerage house Geojit. We asked him this morning why this visit is important. This is what Gaurang told us.
I guess, you know, there is a lot of Indian diaspora built out of UAE. And my sense is that after Prime Minister Modi made the statement of taking the Indian economy to $5 trillion in the next 5 years, I think it is only going to be possible if we try to improve and strengthen a bilateral relationship with almost all the countries, and especially with UAE, because as you rightly mentioned, this will be, I believe, the third visit of Prime Minister Modi to the UAE. A couple of pointers over here. I think basically to have a long, steady, agreement and understanding on bilateral terms as far as India's requirement of crude oil and natural gas is concerned. We are the second largest importer, as we all know. Making the Indian diaspora comfort in terms of how this dream that is going to come through as far as the economy for $5 trillion is concerned. Thirdly, my sense is that, you know, there is slowdown. All of us are worried about slowdown all across the globe and how the yield curves are going inverted, etc. So even in India, there is some amount of expectation that there will be a little bit of, booster, a stimulus, if you will be given to by the government. And I guess to further improve the economic situation. And of course, you know, we all are targeting about 7.5 and higher GDP growth rate. This can only be achieved if we have a stronger relationship with our trade partners.
That's the voice of Gaurang Shah speaking to us from Mumbai. His take on the impending visit of Narendra Modi to the UAE and the economic implications.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott. We're talking loyalty schemes. Manav Fernandez is the co-founder of Quick Brown Fox Consulting. They advise to, well, pretty much everyone. He's signed a lot of non-disclosure agreements, so he's not allowed to tell us who his clients actually are. But if you think of a big brand, he's probably given them some advice or helped them set up their loyalty scheme along the way. Manav, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The question we were asking is whether or not we've reached peak points. What do you think?
No, I think what's happening right now is everybody seems to be jumping on the loyalty bandwagon. But the big game changer is going to be when companies start personalizing their loyalty programs and allowing people to really get, or members to get, what they want out of the program, as opposed to what's happening right now, which is, I've got some dead stock, I've got some product, why don't I just give you that for being my member?
What do, give me an idea of what personalization could look like for an airline loyalty scheme, say.
Well, I think that's interesting. For me personally, the benefit that I get out of my program is access to a lounge, for example, or the chauffeur service that picks me up when I'm traveling. And that's what I want to use my points for. The flight itself, I am going to get from point A to point B. So, you know, I think if they were able to do that better, then I'd be much more happier with my airline program. But, you know, at the end of the day, and I say this to a lot of my clients, a loyalty program is only going to get you so far. It's not a band-aid on great service or a great product. So if you get that right, then do you really need a loyalty program with points?
Which is an interesting thing for a man who helps people set up loyalty programs to say. How many can we actually handle? I mean, out of all the cards that we have and the digital schemes we sign up for, how many do people actually use? One, two, three?
Yeah, I think, again, it's about relevance at the end of the day. The program that is most relevant to me is the program that I am going to use. And again, with currency, if I'm only flying once a year, then that program is not relevant to me. And so, yes, from a travel and hospitality point of view, having a program for a hotel, for example, or an airline program is great for frequent flyers or frequent travelers. But for me, as an everyday, you know, from an everyday usage point of view, perhaps the grocery store program is more relevant. So those are the ones that will pick up traction.
We've been putting a couple of questions out there to the audience this morning. One of them is paid for loyalty programs. Amazon Prime, obviously, is the big one. Kinokuniya, the bookstore chain, has another. Do they work, getting people to pay? Barnes & Noble in the US is another big fish who has one. Getting people to pay for a loyalty scheme.
I think, or I believe rather, the getting the customer value proposition right is basically where is the starting point. So as long as you've done your research and made sure that what you're offering to the customer is what the customer wants, then yes, I'll pay for it. And I think Prime is a great example because it is doing well.
You say that brands, companies have to give customers what they want, but what we as customers want is more, more, more. But these point schemes are big liabilities for large organizations. They're multi-billion dollar liabilities. It's effectively a cryptocurrency that we as members own. So brands have to be careful about not giving too much away. Yeah, of course, for something like Skywoods here in Dubai, it's a massive issue for a lot of people. And we all want Emirates to give us more or Etihad to give us more. But they can't give us more because it's expensive for them. So how do they manage that, Manav? How do they give me or you more of what you want without increasing that liability on the balance sheet? Because the finance chief's going to go, no, no, no.
So I believe, again, there are points holders, people who will keep holding their points. And then on the other end, you've got people who are completely apathetic to the points they get because they're just not enough to ever do anything with. So you've got to give your members the opportunity to redeem their points, maybe outside of your ecosystem, if that's what it's going to take for them to use those points. And again, be relevant. So if I'm only flying once a year or twice a year and I don't earn enough points to ever get myself an upgrade, what is it I can use those points for in order to be able to be relevant or to be engaged with the program?
So let's look at it differently. I'm looking at some research about the American Airlines program, the AAdvantage program, one of the biggest in the world. Research suggests that it had about 850 billion frequent flyer miles outstanding, worth about $2.5 billion, potentially a big liability. But typically, what percentage of miles or points of a big organization like American Airlines or others will ever get used? Is there a kind of an industry benchmark for usage rates for points? 50% get used, 70% get used, 20% get used?
So points that don't get used are called breakage, and they come back into the system, they come back into the business. A good program should actually have the lowest amount of breakage because those points are being used by your members. So depending on the industry, you could have anywhere from 30 to 50% breakage. Now, breakage is not a good thing for a program. It might be good for the business. It might be great for your CFO saying, well, at least the money is not getting used. But ideally, a member of a program spends more than what the number of points that he's actually sitting on. That's the whole point of a program. So I'll give you an example. I go to shop A and I spend $100. You give me 10 back in points, which basically brings me back the next time in order to shop again.
That's Brandy in Country Road in Sydney last week.
And it works.
And it works, exactly. But if I can't use those $10 to do something, then I'm going to either earn more points or use them somewhere else.
Because you can accidentally foster a bit of resentment with a loyalty program, can't you? When I see my, 20,000 miles or my $60 credit or whatever it is expire because I'm not able to cash it in, it's like the anti-loyalty program.
Absolutely. And I think, again, this is where personalization comes in. So, you know, rather than send me that email on my birthday saying, hey, Manu, happy birthday, and your points are about to expire, generating exactly that kind of resentment, why not send me a message saying, we realize you haven't used your points, we'd like to give you an extension by 3 months. And that's where personalization comes in, because if they notice my traveling patterns, and maybe I travel in October and not August regularly, then give me that extension so that I can use them in October.
It sounds great, but it also sounds expensive to figure out what every single person is doing and what they want.
Again, Is it more valuable to hold on and retain your customer, or do you want to lose him and try acquiring a new one? So, you know, that's where it comes down to.
Final question from me. In your view, what's the gold standard of loyalty programs that every industry should aim to emulate?
At a local level, I would say one of the best programs I've come across right now is Emar's You by Emar program. Mm-hmm. Extremely generous. Very relevant. They're working towards personalization, and it crosses a massive sort of realm of segments. So it's got hospitality, they've got the entertainment business, and their properties all covered within one program. So as somebody who lives in Dubai, and I look at that program and think, wow, you're really doing a great job with this.
And internationally?
Internationally, I would probably say Marriott Bonvoy, which was originally Starwood Preferred Guest. Their part of the business was very much the ability to use your points towards experiences as opposed to necessarily just being able to use them for room nights or upgrades or whatever.
Manev Fernandez, co-founder of Quick Brown Fox Consulting. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you again for having me.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Brandy Scott.
Joining us in the studio, Natasha Thomas, news desk editor at the ARN News Centre. And your top story today is that this man is coming to the UAE.
तालियों की गूंज से क्राउन प्रिंस का अभिनंदन कीजिए. क्राउन प्रिंस को स्टैंडिंग ओवेशन दीजिए. भारत माता की. भारत माता की. भारत माता की.
That was 4 years ago yesterday, 18th of August 2015, Narendra Modi at a rally at the cricket stadium here in Dubai. I was there in the crowd. I can't claim to be one of the enthusiastic people screaming and shouting, but he's coming back, Natasha.
He does get those rock star receptions, does he? Yes, he is coming back, and he will visit the UAE later this week. This was a surprise announcement made yesterday. This was made by the Indian Ministry of External Affairs, as well as national news agency WAM, saying that Narendra Modi will be in the Emirates for an official state visit on the 23rd and the 24th of August, which is this weekend. Now, during his trip, Mr. Modi will meet His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who's the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi and Deputy Supreme Commander of the UAE Armed Forces. The two leaders are expected to discuss bilateral, regional and international matters of mutual interest. What's interesting is Mr. Modi will also receive the Order of Zayed, which is the highest civil decoration of the UAE. And after he leaves the UAE, he will go on to Bahrain, where he will meet leaders there.
Now, we know very little about this visit. We've had the official communique and you gave us the details there, but there's no word of what they're going to be talking about. There's not a lot of news about what he's going to be doing here. I mean, we presume that the situation with Kashmir at the moment will be part of those discussions. Economic ties are always part of the discussions. But it's not like the last time he was here when there was a firm agenda, because you were with him on his last visit, which was in February of 2018, wasn't it? And then it was a very formal agenda and lots of different events happening.
Yes, that was a well-planned out trip, and he was here as the chief guest at the World Government Summit, and then he also was a guest at Dubai Opera, where they officially inaugurated the first Hindu temple in Abu Dhabi via a live stream. And that, again, there was a festive atmosphere there. I was there in the opera when all these the expat community was welcoming him. So yes, previously all these visits have been, you know, well charted out. They've been planned for months in advance. But this time around, it seems like it's a surprise visit. And all we know is they will be discussing matters of mutual interest.
And you were with him again a couple of years ago when Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed from Abu Dhabi went on an official visit to India. And you were part of that delegation. That was in New Delhi, or?
That was in New Delhi. This was January 2017. When His Highness went as the chief guest at the Republic Day celebrations. Now, if you know, in India, the Republic Day celebrations are very opulent. We have this massive parade down Janpath, which is a main road in New Delhi. And it's a massive military parade, a lot of processions. And every year, a leader from a country is a chief guest. And that year, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan was the chief guest. And I was part of the official media contingent. And again, that trip was very well planned. A number of memorandums of understanding were signed. Lots of significant announcements from that trip.
Well, you've clearly got close ties to the Indian delegation. So stick by your phone this week, because you might be getting a call. Let's hope so. Stay tuned to Dubai Eye, of course, in the ARN News Centre for details of that visit. Very quickly, one other story that you guys are covering today. A punctual airline out of the United Arab Emirates.
That's right. And that's Etihad Airways. It's been picked as the most punctual Middle Eastern airline in the first 7 months of this year. These are figures produced by the aviation data company OAG. It showed that Etihad was the only carrier in the region whose punctuality averaged more than 80% for flights from January to July. The airline ranked 24th globally for on-time performance in July, which was the peak summer month for air travel in the Middle East. And John Wright, who is Etihad Airways Vice President of Global Airports and Network Operations, has given a statement saying Etihad Airways is a high quality airline and reliability is a key element of the total product they offer.
Those are your top stories today. Brandy's top story, maybe not her top story, but her favourite story is about this.
Oh, I love my pumpkin spice. So it goes down so nice. You can even get it iced. Pumpkin spice. Who cares about the price? It's my one and only vice. Autumn spice is nice. With my pumpkin spice.
Yeah, you two can talk about political visits and economics. I'm going to talk about the pumpkin spice latte. Someone's got to lower the tone.
It has the GDP of a small country. You're entitled to talk about it.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm holding this up as an economic story. The pumpkin spice latte, or the PSL, to those of us in the know, is something of a phenomena. And this year, like last year, funny enough, Starbucks is going to be releasing its early. But Dunkin', the company formerly known as Dunkin' Donuts, is actually going to pip them to the post. Business Insider is reporting that we can expect the Starbucks pumpkin spice latte August the 27th. Dunkin' apparently is bringing this out on August the 21st.
This is ridiculous. These are warming, wintry drinks. That's why they're popular on Halloween, because it's October the 31st and it's getting chilly in most parts of the United States by then. Pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving or Christmas as well. It's a winter thing. It's August, for crying out loud. It's scorching in New York. People are wearing shorts and t-shirts.
Yeah, well, it's a business thing. They're doing it for a couple of reasons. Number one is because it gives a nice bump to sales. when it comes out. The Pumpkin Spice Latte business is worth, well, to Starbucks alone, just for their latte, it's $110 million a year. The Pumpkin Spice economy as a whole, if you take in everything from Pumpkin Spice biscuits to Pumpkin Spice air freshener to Pumpkin Spice hand cream, of which I have some in my house, is worth $600 million.
Wow.
Not to be sneezed at. Pumpkin spice dog food, apparently, also a thing. So they effectively get a nice bump in the numbers when it comes out. The other thing is it does is it gets people into the stores because everyone wants to get one and be one of the first to have one and to stick a picture up on Instagram. And this is the, I mean, this is the truth now. Pumpkin spice lattes are mocked for being a bit basic, and we won't get even into the whole sort of nasty stereotype, which is being basic in the first place. But there's a certain reputation around people who drink flavoured drinks, but the PSL is one that those who love it do so unabashedly and unashamedly, and it's partly an Instagram thing.
You know, my concern with this is I'm sure the marketing gurus behind this know what they're doing, but the reason I guess it's so popular is because it's seasonal. There is an appeal to it because of the seasonality of it. And if they're going to introduce it so early, won't people have an overdose and get sick of it?
Well, see, this is the thing. You couldn't do it all year round or else it wouldn't be a treat. You're absolutely right. But what is known as pumpkin creep, which is the pumpkin spice latte coming earlier and earlier every year, apparently is in response.
You're a pumpkin creep.
To customer demand. And it is because the makers want to get this stuff out there on social media. They want their limited time offerings on social media. So by the time you've seen three or four pictures of one, you want to go and get one yourself. They're quite calorific, it must be said, the old pumpkin spice latte. I limit myself to one or two a season, but I do like them.
Okay, Natasha Thomas, here's a quiz for you. What I'm going to do, I've got the list of the countries ranked by their size of their GDP according to the International Monetary Fund. If pumpkin spice latte was a country, it would be the 179th biggest economy in the world out of 187. I'm going to give you a list of countries and I want you to tell me whether or not the pumpkin spice latte economy is bigger or their economy is bigger. And if you get more than half right, we will buy you, when they come out in the UAE, a pumpkin spice latte.
Okay.
Are you up for the challenge?
I'd like a pumpkin pie. Just putting it out there.
I can bake a pumpkin pie.
Put that to the jury. A pumpkin spice pie?
Yeah, I have those skills. That could happen.
Fine. The Comores, which is bigger, Comores or pumpkin spice economy?
Pumpkin spice economy.
No, the Comores is bigger, 742. Tonga.
Pumpkin spice economy.
Yes, pumpkin spice is bigger. The Marshall Islands.
Pumpkin spice.
Yes, two out of three. Guinea-Bissau.
Pumpkin spice.
No, Guinea-Bissau is three times the size of pumpkin spice. And the Seychelles.
Seychelles.
Well done. You get three out of five right, which is a majority. So a pumpkin pie, lovingly baked by Brandy Scott, is going to be yours when pumpkins are in season. Natasha Thomas, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow morning, bright and early, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.